The BS Report is presented by Subway. Football season is over. Footlong season is just beginning. For a limited time, get any piled high regular footlong for just $5. Any footlong, just $5. Hurry in, Subway. Eat fresh. Eat fresh. The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the BS Report. Very special guest on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline, our former ESPN.com ombudsman, Leanne Schreiber. And we're going to talk about how to pronounce ombudsman and a whole bunch of other things. We had to split this into two parts. The first part you're listening to right now, it's newspapers, and she had extensive experience in the newspaper industry once upon a time. And we're going to talk about that, where it's going, females in newspapers, and all that kind of stuff. That's this podcast. And then part two, we're going to talk about her job as ombudsman at ESPN and really just thoughts about the direction of ESPN in general. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you, Bill?
I'm good. Is it ombudsman, ombudsman, ombudsman? How do you say it?
We'd have to ask a Swede, probably, to get it right. It's a Swedish word. I say ombudsman, but I have no idea if that's right. Mm-hmm.
John Walsh was on the podcast on Friday, and he was saying ombudsman, like he was doing a boods there.
Boods. Well, you know, normally I would defer to him, but I don't think he's Swedish.
Yeah, he's not. He's very, very, very Irish.
Oh, but I'll take this moment to answer a question I never did in the column. Lots of people, you know, thought it was sexist not to say ombudswoman, you know, sort of like chairwoman, and blame that on ESPN. And in fact, it was my choice to be called ombudsman because it's a Swedish word. It's gender neutral. The M-A-N ending in Swedish doesn't mean man. It just means human being.
Hmm.
And Swedes are very proud that that word, I mean, I think it's the only word other than smorgasbord that has made it from Swedish to English, you know, in a big way. So I didn't want to mess with their word, ombudsman.
You might make a run at most intelligent BS Report guests we've ever had by the time this is over.
I'll give it a try, or I may completely blow my reputation by the end of the podcast as well.
Well, you know, the whole ombudsman, ombudswoman thing, I wanted to get your take before we delved into newspapers, because I really want you to talk about newspapers and
sure.
ESPN and stuff. But the whole your take on the whole thing where Barack Obama kind of came under fire last week because he didn't fill out a woman's bracket. Do we go too far with this stuff sometimes?
Yes, I think so. Just because he happens to have terrific personal interest in men's college basketball, so that he's informed enough and engaged enough to, you know, fill out a, you know, smart bracket, doesn't mean he has the same interest or has to have the same interest in women's basketball.
Right.
If he did, he would have filled one out. But, you know, being the fan of one doesn't mean you have to be a fan of the other or feel guilty about it.
Well, Christine Brennan in the USA Today was saying that, you know, he has two daughters. How could he do that when, you know, his daughters might grow up to be women's basketball players someday, the responsibility to them to fill out a bracket and all that. I mean, you've been in the industry for, say, really since the 70s, right? You were the New York Times sports editor in the late 70s,
yes.
If I got that correctly. So you were one of the first female sports editors ever, I'm guessing.
They said I was the first to head a department. There had certainly been others who were sports reporters or sports editors or copy editors, but I think I was thought to be the first who was the department head.
Okay, so you were entrenched in the sports industry when there was real sexism.
Yeah.
And now I think I think we're pretty good at this point. Are people like looking to pick fights now at this point?
Well, to an extent, yeah. I mean, there, you know, political correctness sometimes strays too far afield. And in this case, my personal opinion is that it did. I'm a fan of women's college basketball. You know, and I have been since the 70s. You know, I watched it grow up. So I'm a fan. But that doesn't mean anybody else need be. And, you know, the president isn't filling out brackets in every single sport or, you know, opining on every single sport. He happens to be a, college basketball fan of men's basketball.
That's right, and arguably he probably shouldn't have even spent that time filling out the men's bracket. So I think spending the extra 10 minutes on the women, I think, might have pushed people over the edge. When you, you know, you took over the New York Times during a totally, totally different era, not just for sports, but for male-female relationships in the workplace and the way female sports was regarded at the time. When you look back at that, what is the biggest difference between then and what we see now, where everything is obviously a lot more equal?
Well, there's just no comparison. When I was named sports editor of the Times, and that was 1978, it was like it was an international incident. For the first 6 to 8 months of that job, which was hard enough as it was, you know, because we were putting out, you know, three editions a day, two special sections a week. I was trying to run a department of, you know, 60 people. I was the only woman. I was 33 years old. Most of my staff was, you know, mean age of about 55. It was a rough enough situation as it was. But at least 4 or 5 hours a day, I was giving interviews because it was considered a professional courtesy that if somebody asked you within a new, you know, if a newspaper or television station asked, it was considered a professional courtesy to go ahead and do it.
So you couldn't pick and choose?
No. There were film crews traipsing through the sports department from France, from Japan, from Denmark. You know, every small and large newspaper in the country. And there were headlines. There were headlines in newspapers around the country, mostly smaller market ones.
Favorable headlines or non-favorable?
They were, you judge, broad named sports editor of the New York Times.
Wow.
Gal named sports editor of the New York Times. I had to get my phone number unlisted for the first time because of the number of phone-at-home death threats I received. I had, you know, reams, dozens and dozens of sort of death threats as being part of some kind of pinko communist conspiracy, the naming of a female, you know, sports editor of the New York Times. It's as if I had been named, you know, quarterback of the NFL. Totally bizarre. And you can't even imagine those kind of circumstances now.
And a lot of, like, obviously mean-spirited emails, stuff like that.
Email didn't exist, Bill.
I mean, not email. letters. I'm sorry.
Snail mail. Lots of mean snail mail. But then also, I mean, the flip side of it was, then I was also lionized and praised beyond any reason before I had ever done anything. So, you know, I was either the witch or, you know, Saint Joan of Arc, you know, who some also regarded as a witch. But I completely lost... completely lost control of any personal identity. You know, I just became an emblem. I mean, and not certainly in my personal life and not within the sports department and not among colleagues, but it was my first taste of what it, and last, really, of what it might like be like to be a celebrity, and it's awful. You know, any notion that you could control your own image or the way you're perceived, for better or worse, you know, just went totally out the door.
So when they offered you that job, you just took the job because it was a good job. You weren't expecting all the other stuff, or were you?
I took the job in the spirit of a military conscript.
Oh.
I had no desire for that job. No.
Really?
Zero. Zip. But my real interest at that time, or my deeper interest, was in political and cultural reporting. And I had come to the Times sports department with the understanding that I would be there for a year to help them launch Sports Monday, which you probably don't even remember, but I mean the New York Times was going through this period of introducing what they call their C sections and trying to catch up with the Times Times small t by introducing all sorts of feature writing and more magazine-like coverage to straight game reporting. And it was my background in, you know, magazine and literary stuff that they wanted me to bring that set of skills to help revamp the sports section. And they brought me in as a deputy editor. And the understanding was after a year, then I would go to either the Foreign Desk or the Book Review or, you know. But within that year, they decided to name me sports editor. And it was really a can't refuse because of the cultural moment. At that point in time, the New York Times had never had a female department head in any section except for what was called the women's page.
Wow. There's a women's page?
It had just changed from being sort of the women's page to, you know, the home section, the style section.
Okay. Gotcha.
And there was a wonderful woman, Charlotte Curtis, who, you know, for 15 or 20 years had presided over what was initially called the women's page and then, you know, morphed into more lifestyle kind of characterizations. And because the presumption was that you just couldn't have a female boss of predominantly male employees, that they wouldn't sit for it. And
that they wouldn't respect her, or that it was like a sexual thing?
You know, it's sort of like the army. It was like, you know, they wouldn't, it just wouldn't work, you know, that male employees couldn't have a female boss. It would be humiliating. They wouldn't give respect. It wouldn't work. And so for the first, they were thrusting my head like a battering ram through the glass ceiling.
Yeah.
And it had impact not only for sports departments, but for women in newspapers across the country. And you sort of can't say no.
Right.
You know?
But were
really
you a sports
like
fan?
Like social
though?
Service. Pardon?
Were you a sports fan though, or casual, or diehard? At the time.
The whole sports thing, initially, and then again, you know, in this tenure as ombudsman, was really a fluke. I had, you know, I was one of those, I had been doing, foreign affairs. I had been writing for the world section of Time Magazine, doing foreign affairs, as my first journalism job, out of graduate school. In an English department, so that made no sense either. But, you know, there's flukes all along the way. And in 1976, when I was writing foreign affairs, Time Magazine in summer of 1976 had the first and, I believe, last strike in its history. And all of us writers were, you know, out on the picket line surrounding the Time Life building. And it lasted for 3 weeks, and during that period they lost their sports writer, a guy named Phil Taubman, who was later at the New York Times as a terrific, he became Washington Bureau Chief, and he also spent time in China. But anyway, strike's over. It's about 3 weeks before the Montreal Olympics. They don't have anybody to cover it.
Yeah.
They don't even have credentials arranged, and they need to just sort of like throw somebody into that fire. And
that was you?
And that was me. And so I went to the Montreal Olympics by myself with one researcher, never having covered sports before in my life, never having intended to cover sports before in my life, my credential having been a reputation for playing a really good second base on the Time Inc. baseball team.
Right.
And that was my trial by fire. And I wrote you know, three cover stories in 3 weeks on the Montreal Olympics, having had no experience whatsoever.
Bruce Jenner, Sugar Ray Leonard, Nadia Comaneci.
Yes. I discovered, you know, my way of going about it, I mean, it's amazing I landed on my feet. I mean, I got tremendous help from the people, you know, like Newsweek had about 20 people there. You know,
yeah.
Sports Illustrated had about 20 people there. When they saw that, you know, this, you know, young woman who had never covered sports before in her life was Time Magazine, they once thought it was hilarious. I was the butt of all their jokes. But the, like the two Petes, Pete Axhelm and Pete Bonventry and lots of wonderful people just sort of helped me out. But also because I only had one set of legs, you know, I didn't have all this help. I saw the first day I was in Montreal, I happened to go to, you know, the facility where the gymnastics practices were happening, and I saw this Nadia Comaneci, and I'd never covered gymnastics before in my life. I don't believe I'd ever seen gymnastics before in my life, but, you know, she was whizzing around those bars in a way that seemed, you know, insane to me. And I said, well, this has got, just using my eyeballs, you know, everybody else had reams of research about the smart money and this, that, and the other, and I only had my eyeballs for that whole Olympics. So I decided she's got to be the story of the first week of the Olympics. And I called my boss in New York and said, I've got to concentrate because I only got one pair of legs and there's all these venues, and I'm going to, you know, stick with her. And they said, you can't possibly do that. It's too dangerous. You could have an accident. You have to cover the whole thing. And I said, well, sure, okay. But I couldn't. So
yeah.
I went ahead and, you know, I set up interviews, which was not so easy, getting through Cold War Romanian, you know, paranoia. But by the time she made her splash, I already had my interviews, and then the rest of the other 11,000 members of the press corps were all trying to get in at once.
See, so that helped you.
That helped me.
I always feel like when somebody's like an outsider to a whole experience, that sometimes that's a good thing. It's an advantage. You're just looking at it like with common sense
yes.
from an outside perspective.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, at least that's the way I function, the way I personally function best. And it's the most enjoyable.
Isn't that kind of what happened with you with this ESPN ombudsman? Ombudsman?
Yes.
Ombudsman.
Yes, because believe me, in the 25 intervening years between my being in sports journalism and my being ombudsman, I had not been following sports closely.
Yeah.
I had experienced a severe overdose during the period of my being sports editor of the New York Times.
Right.
It was totally out of the blue when John Walsh called me, and I was really in some, you know, I really came to ESPN as a virgin.
Right. When you were running the Times in the late 70s, that was the big issue back then was should females be allowed in the locker room?
Yes.
And, you know, I always thought that would make a fascinating documentary that nobody's ever made, because everything kind of happened in the same 7-8 year span, and then it was kind of undermined a tiny bit by what happened with Samantha Stevenson, who had an affair with Dr. J, and actually, as it turned out, had his illegitimate kid. Was that something that you guys even knew about back then, or was it like rumored about, or was it just came out of the blue when it was revealed?
That came out of the blue, but I was very involved in the women in the locker room battles.
Yeah. yeah.
in the sports department. I wasn't the one who had to go into the locker room, but I was the one who was meeting with the commissioners of various sports, meeting with Bowie Kuhn and, you know, meeting with Larry O'Brien, who was in commissioner of basketball.
Right.
Football commissioner didn't want to have anything to do with me. But I was the one who was making the case dealing with, you know, the commissioners for why it was so important and why it was essential.
And they wanted no part of it. Yeah, they wanted no part of it, correct?
It depended. it depended. Larry O'Brien, who was commissioner of basketball, was totally supportive. I mean, he was somebody who had come out of, you know, the Kennedy civil rights, position. Hockey was very supportive because they wanted the coverage, you know? Baseball was very resistant. Bowie Kuhn, was very resistant, but, Melissa Ludke from Sports Illustrated had brought the lawsuit against the Yankees. And, I think to this day, people don't know why it was so important. At least from my point of view, much of the reasoning behind my taking on the position of being sports editor of the Times, which was not really a personal desire, taking on that battle, you know, you can't be a sports reporter unless you can get in the locker room. I mean, you just can't. Certainly at a daily newspaper. You can't compete against all the beat writers who are getting into the locker room and getting those quotes. However banal those quotes are, you still have to have them. And so you say, okay, what does it matter in the course of the world if, you know, women aren't sports reporters? Well, if women aren't sports reporters, they're probably, you're reducing their possibility of being reporters of any kind by at least 50%.
Well, it's also discrimination.
Well, yes, but it's a discrimination that has a tremendous, the discrimination within a sports department has tremendous consequences, because if you, particularly at that time, well, to this day, if you go to any newspaper, the largest departments are sports departments and the local, you know, metropolitan section. That's where all the initial hiring happens. Everybody who comes to a newspaper usually starts on either the city desk or the sports desk. And they are the largest departments. And if you eliminate a sports department, as the, as a employment option for women in journalism, you've right there cut the number of opening positions for women in half.
Yeah.
Because, as you know, people begin in sports departments, end up in national news and foreign news. And, you know, Maureen Dowd started in a sports department.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So it's the opening hiring. City desks and sports desks are the route of entry for about 90% of journalists of all kinds.
So what year did you leave?
I left...
the sports section.
The sports section, when I had signed on for it, you know, in the spirit of military conscript, I said, let me do it for 2 years. I said to Abe Rosenthal and Arthur Gelb, who were then the two top guys at the Times, who were putting me in this position. And I said, let me do it for 2 years. In 2 years, I can have proved whatever point or not is
right
to be made about a woman department head at the Times. And in 2 years, I can have whatever impact I'm capable of having on working with a sports department that is making this transition to a new kind of journalism. And after those 2 years, then I would like to be reassigned to either the foreign desk, the book review, or whatever. So I finished my 2 years, and I went back to them, and I said, okay, 2 years are up. We proved the point. Could I have a transfer? And they said no. They'd become attached to the idea of their first lady sports editor.
Wow.
And I was actually crestfallen. I didn't want to be in this position anymore. I didn't want that high visibility. I didn't want those 80-hour work weeks. And I didn't want that total concentration on sports when I had many other interests as well. So, you know, I put my tail between my legs and went back to work. And after about 3 or 4 more months, I went back and I said, I resign.
Wow.
And they said, you can't resign. Just as they said, you can't have a transfer, they said, you can't resign. And I said, well, I certainly can, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's within my power. And they said, if you resign, if you leave the Times, if you resign and leave the Times, nobody will believe you resigned. They will say we have abused and misused our first woman department head. And I said, well, that's not my problem. And I'm resigning. And that's when they swung into gear and said, okay, well, we have these openings. You know, you can't leave the Times. It'll look too bad. And so we looked about for a solution, and I went at that point to be deputy editor of the Book Review, where I lived happily for about, I was there for about 4 years, and I loved it. But at the end of 4 years, I thought, this is the best job I'm ever going to have.
This sounds like a Meryl Streep movie.
Well, and but I wanted this is a great job. This is the best job I'm ever going to have. I've had a great run here, but I'm tired of being within large institutions. I just want to work on my own.
And that's what you did.
And that's what I did.
So, what do you think about what's happened in newspapers? And do you see any chance that, other than maybe the Times and the Wall Street Journal and that's about it. Do you see any chance that they're going to be saved and make money?
Oh, I mean, it breaks my heart. And, you know, I'm worried even about that the New York Times, that the Washington Post, that the Wall Street Journal could survive.
I couldn't see those three going. I almost feel like the president would have to step in and come up with some sort of rule that they, you know, like what people have been talking about how charitable contributions or it becomes a nonprofit organization or something. It's just, it's hard to fathom that those three newspapers could go under.
Well, it's hard, but the financial difficulties that they're, and hurdles that they're facing, and the staff cutbacks that they're all having to do. I mean, so even if they survive, are they going to survive as anything as
right.
powerful as we have known them to be?
Well, I worry about journalistically. You know, there's not really this, not really. I mean, there isn't the same libel and slander laws on the internet as there are with newspapers and the printed word. And if newspapers shift to the internet, what does that mean for journalistic accountability?
Well, I'm worried that they'd be able to make the shift. I mean, I think if the New York Times or the Washington Post, you know, ended up being entirely online operations.
Yeah.
The same standards would apply because they would apply them to their brand, to their name, you know. It's whether the internet can ever generate sufficient revenue to support the kind of staffing, you know, that a newspaper has. And it's that kind of staffing that, you know, provides the reliability of the information.
Right.
So that's my great concern. And it's not, you know, I particularly worry about foreign news. Because
how expensive
there are
it is.
So few sources of it. There always have been. I mean, that was one of the things I first learned, you know, when I was being in the world section of Time magazine. That there's just often a handful of bodies, from a handful of major newspapers and television stations who are actually on the scene, you know,
yeah.
getting the information. And it's very easy to manipulate. And foreign news is one of the most costly, departments. The fund, you know, you're paying all those travel expenses, and it's one of the things that newspapers have really cut back on is is they're staffing of foreign news. And the fewer bodies you have in place in news institutions like the Times and the Washington Post, the easier that news becomes to manipulate.
Right.
So that people just start taking what, you know, State Departments and, you know, military chiefs of staff are saying about a situation, and that there's no independent research and reporting going on. And it seems to me very dangerous. And, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot. It's sort of like the Internet, on the one hand, whether it's in sports or foreign news or national politics, anybody can chime in. All you have to have is access to a computer.
Yep.
And on the one hand, that breaks a bottleneck. You know, we're not as dependent on a handful of institutions to be the conduit for everything we know about a foreign situation. People, you know, on the ground, you know, people in Pakistan or people in Iraq or can be posting direct eyewitness information. On the other hand, there's no vetting of that information. So that you have potentially many more sources of information than you do when the mainstream media is your only conduit. And on the other hand, you have no safeguards whatsoever about the reliability of that information, what agenda is driving that information. It's sort of like, I'll probably get in trouble for this analogy.
And oh, please say it.
Taken with a grain of salt, but it's almost like the mainstream media is the Catholic Church, you know, with its, you know, priests and bishops and cardinals. There's no pope. You have to get rid of the pope. But, you know, it has this elaborate structure that mediates between us and information. And it has that elaborate structure in order to ideally provide and rules and ethics to provide the reliability of that information. So we get if we trust them, a degree of reliability for the dependence on them as our intermediaries. And the blogosphere or the Internet is more like, you know, like dissenting Protestantism. You know, we don't need these intermediaries. You know, say instead of information, you got God. You know, instead of God, you have information. And we don't need the priests, bishops, and cardinals of the mainstream media to stand between us and information. Give us a direct relation to it.
Right. That makes sense.
It places a tremendous burden on every consumer of that information to be making all sorts of judgments about its reliability.
I was just going to say that it puts the onus on the person that's consuming the information. In the past, you would be able to have that information disseminated to you.
If the more local the information is, the greater likelihood is that the consumer can, if they make the effort,
right,
can train himself, if he's willing, to sort out the likely reliability of the information, given who its source is, and sort out, you know, rumor from fact, you know, if they care. But the farther away that news is, once it becomes a foreign land, you know.
Well, I also wonder about reporting. And this is something that a show called The Wire, which was on HBO, it was five seasons.
Love The Wire.
Oh, good. The last season, which was amazing at the time, but now is really amazing considering how fast these newspapers are falling. You know, the last season is about what's happening in newspapers and how the foundation of the city is crumbling. And because newspapers are also crumbling, they can't capture what's happening in the city. And I think, like, you know, I was watching On the President's Men 2 weekends ago, and you just watch how Woodward and Bernstein, not only the fact that they attacked that story and just kept pushing at it and pushing at it and pushing at it, but they were also surrounded by really talented people who were telling that, you know, giving them feedback and telling them to ease back or go for it or whatever. And I also worry about that part, where with newspapers, a lot of the talented people are now getting hired to TV stations or websites or magazines or whatever. Yeah, you look at ESPN, we've poached basically all these top sports editors from around the country. I don't know. I think that's almost as dangerous.
Yeah. There's been one interesting development that I noticed just in the last, just in the last couple of weeks. And as I say, to me, in some ways, the bellwether is foreign news. That's what I'm most worried about losing.
Yeah.
With newspapers. My attachment isn't so much to the, holding the physical object in my hand. If the entire reliability of the best newspapers could be transferred to the internet, I'd be fine. So it's not about nostalgia about holding the thing in my hand, although I like holding the thing in my hand sometimes.
So does my dad.
Too much inky print on my hands. It's more about losing that whole structure of reliability, which takes a huge staff that the internet has not shown itself capable of paying for yet. But, there's this new outfit, really just launched or just that I'm just hearing about. There's something called globalpost.com, and it's providing international news. And it is being staffed from the start by people who come out of the Washington Post, the New York Times, universities, award-winning reporters, people who have studied at the, Nieman Foundation, for journalism at Harvard. And it seems to be a recognition that we, somebody has to start creating internet-based institutions as reliable as those we, have depended on in the mainstream media. Not coincidentally, I noticed just this week, the New York Times has started a new online edition called New York Times Global. And you can toggle between the regular NewYorkTimes.com and the NewYorkTimesGlobal.com, in which they're putting together their, the International Herald, which has operated in Paris for decades, with the New York Times to create a whole different edition. It's the first sign of hope to me that there's going to be efforts to create online newspapers.
Yeah, that's interesting.
That are going to work. But again, I think both of these, like this globalpost.com, it's very unclear. They're going to try to get, revenue streams from advertising, from subscription. It's not clear that the model is going to work.
I just went on the website as you were talking about it. It seems like they have some partners.
Globalpost.com?
Yeah, the globalpost.com and their partners are World Focus, Pulitzer Center, The Huffington Post, BillO'Reilly.com. That's a little scary.
Whoa, that's strange.
And Douchewell, which must be, I don't know what that is, some sort of bank or something. But, yeah, so maybe they just keep partnering up with different people and getting money from different sources.
The other thing that may start happening is, really serious partnerships between newspapers and cable television stations.
Right.
News stations. Because to a great extent, cable news and the blogosphere is still very dependent upon newspapers and their reporting to provide the information on which the whole mountain of opinionation that dominates cable and internet depends.
Where do you see the blogosphere fitting into this whole thing? Because it seems to me that if I'm a young writer, age 22, it would be a much easier path to get read to just become a blogger versus, working at a newspaper, potentially losing my job, grinding away for 10 years, or else trying to become a columnist or whatever. It just seems like, you start any kind of blog, whether it's gossip or sports or politics or whatever, you might get eyeballs right away.
Yeah.
That's a bad thing, correct?
Well, it depends. I don't see the internet or the blogosphere as the enemy. I see it as the new technology of communications.
Right.
That is probably going to, well, it already is. It's superseding, you know, print newspapers and other forms of print. So it's a matter of whether institutions, as reliable as certain parts of the mainstream media, can exist on the internet. And it's also, you know, for my personal taste, the blogosphere is too, I make it larger than my personal taste. I think for the good of an informed citizenry, if we want to be, you know, high-minded about it, the blogosphere, like cable news, is too opinion-driven.
Yeah.
But that's not an inevitability. There is nothing to prevent those young, aspiring journalists who are coming out of college, who don't see a future for themselves in newspapers, there's nothing to prevent them from using the blogosphere, you know, to begin reporting, you know, careers or information-driven careers. I mean, I would like to believe that the pendulum is going to be swinging a bit away from the valuing of opinion and swinging towards, again, the value of information and reporting. And there's no reason the blogosphere can't be used in that way.
I hope you're right.
Except that gathering information and doing reporting is a more labor-intensive and therefore cost-intensive, you know, thing to do.
I hope you're right. I don't see the blogosphere as the enemy either. I mean, I think for the large part, it's had a good impact on everything. But my concern is that people who are coming up, who are trying to learn how to write and learn what works and doesn't work, that they're just
going to have the training.
They're not only not going to have the training, but they're not going to take chances and they're not going to test themselves. It's just too easy to emulate what's working for other people. And I know, like in my case, you know, I had a column at my college newspaper for 4 years. I worked at a newspaper for 3 years. And then I had a website that, you know, I had for 4 years that I'm just trying every kind of column, topic, and idea, trying to figure out what works and doesn't work. And basically had this huge, huge chance to just kind of figure out my style and figure out what I was doing. By the time I got to ESPN, you know, I was kind of ready. And that, now, you know, if it had been 10 years later, and I was just online and trying to get eyeballs right away, and I was. I think that would have had a bad impact on me. You know, I don't know if I would have gotten better. Does that make sense?
Yeah. On the other hand, anybody can go on to the internet, create their own blog, and start getting eyeballs to some extent.
Yeah.
Not anybody can do that and make any kind of income from it.
Yeah, that's true.
To get any kind of income from being on the internet, you're going to have to offer something special. And could be, you know, that that sites and start developing that offer something of sufficient value and sufficient uniqueness that, you know, it'll start paying for itself. And I think, you know, kind of cloned opinion is not going to be what that is.
Yeah, you're right. All right, that wraps up part one of our interview with Leanne Schreiber on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. Check out part two, which is about ESPN and her job and her relationship with ESPN, as well as mine, on the BS.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.
And that concludes another episode of the BS Report. And here's 55 more words that Bill Simmons intended to mention, but unfortunately ran out of time. Now you can get any regular piled high Subway footlong for just $5. The keyword is any. The sweet onion chicken teriyaki, savory chicken and bacon ranch, the meaty taste bud pleasing Italian BMT. All the regular famous Subway footlongs, just $5. Subway, eat fresh. See store for details.